and welcome to Worlds Apart. When Charlie Chaplin started calling for the United States to help the USSR in the war against Nazism, it was the beginning of his downfall. Soon after, he was accused of communist sympathies, the media turned against him, and he was ultimately forced to leave the United States. Nevertheless, America did open up a second front, and World War II ended with the defeat of the warmongering party. Can that offer any lessons for the present moment in the U.S.-Russia relationship? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Maxim Suchpov, director of the Institute for International Studies at MGIMO University in Russia. Maxim, it's amazing to see you again, to talk to you. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
Now, I chose to begin with this allusion to Charlie Chaplin because he wasn't afraid to risk the stardom, the social capital of his movie persona, accidentally called the Tramp, for what he believed in as a human being. And we now have another person with a similarly sounding last name, but with much greater powers, attempting to do a similar feat. What do you make of Donald Trump's peacemaking efforts so far?
Well, first of all, I think he's genuine in his desire to, settle the conflict. And I think we have to be realistic in saying that the conflict at the moment cannot be resolved and that can be settled. And I think he's made some important moves as to how the United States policy evolved even, within this like 3 to 4 months since he took office. But there are still important, fumbling blocks on the road, and then for the moment, a lot of things that both the Trump administration and his envoys are talking about are not necessarily addressing the root causes of the conflict. And of course, there's a lot of way to go. I mean, you mentioned Charlie Chaplin, and I think Trump himself, throughout his career, has been in two worlds: the world of big money, the businessman is an entrepreneur, and the world of emotions and shows, the world of media. And that actually demands from you different tactics and how you behave and how you do things.
Can I ask you about that? Because I've long been fascinated by this role that big emotions, ostracizing emotions like fear, shame, embarrassment, scorn, play in the American politics and American public life in terms of manufacturing the desired outcome, manufacturing consent. And it seems to take a very specific kind of person to be able to not only withstand this emotional pressure, but actually deal with it and sometimes deflect it back to the adversaries. What do you think is ultimately driving Trump?
Graham Allison, one of the patriarchs of American foreign policy, once noted that everyone is taking Trump literally but not seriously, while it should be the other way around. People should be taking him seriously but not literally. And I think that's kind of a good formula to look at how Trump is moving on things. And during the election campaign, I think the Democrats have exploited the emotion of fear and have to scare the American voters from the type of America that will be engulfed by Trumpism, whereas the Trump supporters have exploited the emotion of anger. Trump has eventually emerged as a candidate of angry white men predominantly in the first campaign, and then it became more kind of complicated during the second campaign. In the past campaign, the Democrats tried to infuse the idea of the future and joy. You remember all this kind of fake joyful campaign by Kamala Harris and Tim Walz, but they were not the right people, that Americans did not believe that message.
Now, Maxim, you have written before that Trump cares first and foremost about his own interests, but he's selfish in a new, more realistic, more pragmatic sort of way. And I think it's this pragmatism, or I would even say literalism, this ability to ground discussions in something concrete, I think that's the quality that the Kremlin appreciates in the new administration. What do you think?
I agree. I think this is the type of language that Kremlin has long wanted to hear from the West and from the United States leadership in particular. Some may say this is the language of the great powers, that, Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump speak the same language in that sense. Others may think, well, that's a type of a language that has, helped both powers navigate their differences during the Cold War. Because, everyone is talking about the Cold War 2.0, but this is actually a period of history where, you know, being able to speak in pragmatic terms enabled the two powers to do things and at the same time disagree on other things. So I think that type of language is exactly quite comfortable and understandable, at least for, mm-hmm. for people.
And I think it also has a sort of a grounding and reality connecting streak to it. And Trump himself was very public about his disdain for freeloaders, who he thinks rip America off. But I think if we look at it in strategic terms, this tendency of the United States to subsidize and finance its allies did create a sort of moral hazard problem where countries like Poland, Estonia, and lately Ukraine act in not just belligerent, but far more reckless way than the immediate resources, that the immediate circumstances or the size of their militaries allow them. And I wonder if that's one of the main problems, one of the main structural reasons for the downfall of the Western-led order, this moral hazard problem embedded with it.
There were two kind of streams of thought in the Russian thinking about the West-led order. One suggested that there was, since the breakup of the Soviet Union, the so-called kind of manufactured consensus, imposed consensus that the United States elites imposed on the rest of the world to try to create the idea that there is a consensus and everyone agrees with whatever America is doing. Others thought that America was on top because it was able to create a number of incentives for a great number of its allies who are now running to defend Pax Americana, even when the United States seeks to amend it. And I think Trump is now offering a new type of American dominance that is kind of nationalist as opposed to the globalist. But he's also did something very important, I think, for the first time, at least since the breakup of the bipolar system. He kind of separated the component of leadership and the component of dominance. He still wants the United States to dominate in some of the key areas, but he doesn't seem to want to take leadership on some of the entanglements that he believes did not serve America well.
One of the very popular words in his vocabulary is real. And I think when we, if we take the concept of realism literally, both literally and seriously, what is ultimately to be in touch with reality? It's to coordinate your aims and your means to, because, I mean, we learn about reality from our immediate interaction with it. But if you are, you know, underwritten by, a powerful ally, your perception of reality, your perception of yourself will be distorted. And somehow it escaped from, you know, the mind of strategic thinkers in either Ukraine or Poland or many other European countries. Do you think it's destined to come back, or do you think they will attempt to sort of live in a world where their abilities are much greater than they are, like, in material terms?
I think part of your question is answered by Secretary Rubio in one of his first interviews, where he talked about this idea of multipolarity, where he thought, or he kind of voiced the whatever, there's the consensus within the administration that the previous era of U.S. policy was actually serving too many players, too many allies, without some specific real outcomes for the United States. So America was kind of burdened by a number of, entanglements, obligations, you name it. That is somewhat different view from what Russia believes, because Russia, as we know, believes that since the 1990s, because there was no kind of counterweight to American dominance in the world, America thought, you know, they can do whatever they want without, you know, meeting any. So this administration believes this was kind of unnecessary burden because there was no one else to share this responsibility with. U.S. kind of assumed the responsibility of a kind of world policeman, and now they want to reassess it. But that, like I said, it's a different type of leadership. It's kind of nationalist idea against the globalist idea. Maybe this policy will be too expansive, and, you know, in the next administration, in 10 years, some new American elites would come back and say, well, actually, we think the globalism actually served us well.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking about carrying the burden, Trump said the other day, very succinctly, I thought, in relation to Ukraine, that, you know, you don't start a war against somebody who is 20 times your size and then ask people to provide you with missiles. And, you know, it's a very poignant statement, because up until recently, the whole argument in the West was centering around who started the kinetic phase of the conflict. But he's actually pointing the finger not just at Ukraine, but he's accusing Ukraine of warmongering. He says that you don't start a war. He is not saying that Russia started it, actually. How do you think this will be received in Ukraine? Do you think there is any chance of the leadership in Ukraine assessing the situation around them and, you know, coming to some sense of not necessarily even reality, but what their immediate interests and possibilities are?
Well, I think any departure from the previous U.S. position is painful to Ukraine. So that remark by Trump is a departure from the previous U.S. position. He made it clear during his meeting with the Zelensky in the White House that he sees U.S. as in the middle, as opposed to on the Ukraine side. And that's also a painful reality for Ukrainians. And I think since 2022, there was a key disagreement between kind of this information flows and the narrative that the Russia promoted and the West promoted, where Russia said it's basically a war of necessity for us, whereas the West said it's a war of choice. Hence, we hear these different rhetorics, you know, on Russia's kind of full-scale invasion, as if, you know, it started all of a sudden, whereas Russia is telling you how it came to that point and how it's bad. So I think Trump's reassessment of that is also kind of getting more comprehensive of how things actually were in the past and how they are in the present.
Now, speaking of which, John Mearsheimer, one of the top American political scientists, gave an interview recently, and he essentially made a similar point in relation to the European Union, rather, saying that Ukraine and continuing with this war is essentially a device for the EU to keep the bloc together. And his argument was that with America decreasing its services to Ukraine and without this externalized, concocted threat, the EU cannot stay as one piece, because there is nothing to keep it integrated from within. There are multiple economic, social, what have you, challenges. And if the war is solved somehow, then the EU would inevitably disintegrate into some sort of squabbles, mm-hmm. hopefully not fighting, not direct fighting. What do you think about it?
Well, I think Professor Mearsheimer's argument speaks to a very important observation, which is neither Ukraine nor European Union have a positive agenda, whereas the United States with Trump started to have a positive agenda. At least they are trying to build a new vision, a new reality for themselves. That would mean, you know, taking lead in the AI, other things. They have agenda other than the conflict in Ukraine, whereas Ukrainians and Europeans do not have that agenda. And of course, the Zelensky cabinet and the Europeans have rallied around this, you know, Russia war thing, and they are now building their future around a conflict or the conflict with Russia. That is actually a bad thing in terms of it does not leave a lot of room for compromise. It actually leaves Russia with no other choice rather than, you know, try to put the lid on the system and make it boil with their own internal contradictions in the best hope that the warmongers will get evaporated at some point and new people come to power.
We will take a very short break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
готовности, корабль.
Выстрел!
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Maxim Suchkov, director of the Institute for International Studies at MGIMO University in Russia. Maxim, let's talk about the ongoing U.S.-Russia negotiations. Stephen Witkoff, Trump's special envoy, has just had his third meeting with a Russian president, the one that lasted, I think, for approximately 5 hours. And knowing the habits of the Russian leaders, of the Russian leader, rather, I think we can say that whenever he invests that much time and effort into something, that's not ceremonial. Now, given Russia's long-held grievances and Putin's long-held personal grievances against the West, you know, deceiving Russia on multiple occasions, why do you think he is so committed to this opportunity?
I think two reasons. One is actually for the first time since late 80s, early 1990s, there is this understanding within the Russian leadership that there is no collective West, as we came to call it here, that there is a real strategic difference, you know, the difference in the strategic vision between the Europeans and the Americans now. And since perhaps the late 1940s, there is an understanding that the American strategic vision is closer to the Russian than the European. And whether it takes, you know, 5 hours, 10 hours, five meetings, 10 meetings, anything is worth it as long as you're using this time to talk through your differences, to seek, you know, points of convergence and see how you can avoid the worst case scenarios and move forward.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking about strategic, America's strategic interest, I mentioned John Mearsheimer before, and he also made a very interesting point that ultimately, one of the reasons why Trump seems to be so committed to this track is not because he's seeking, you know, a Nobel Peace Prize, but that the United States has a vested interest in having a workable, predictable relationship with Russia, that it actually goes far beyond Trump. And it's, you know, Washington needs it perhaps even more than Moscow. Do you agree with that assessment?
Well, first of all, I don't think this the Nobel Prize seeking and, you know, serving your country's interests are mutually exclusive. But in seriousness, you know, any U.S. president acts in three kind of domains: as a bureaucrat, as a politician who seeks re-election and the best for his party, and as a commander-in-chief. So as a commander-in-chief, I think there is this view within the Trump administration, with Trump personally, that good relations with Russia, or normalized, at least, relations with Russia, serve U.S. interests best, full stop. And then there is, you know, this whole architecture surrounding on how to normalize it, given the a number of huge blocks on the way.
Mm-hmm. Now, I also heard you say in a recent interview that this previous belief that, you know, somehow the U.S.-Russia or the U.S.-USSR relationship are the main one determining the nature of the international system, that argument, many people thought that argument was outdated, but apparently, you know, it's been buried prematurely, because many countries to this point are watching the dynamic between Washington and Moscow and adjusting their own policies to that rather than trying to chart their own course. Why is that?
Well, look, if we think of U.S.-China relations as kind of the centerpiece of the current world politics, as a lot of people think, it is about the future of the world, right? How the power balances would look like, how, you know, trade would look like, what type of AI would define how people work, live, and interact with one another. So it is indeed about the future. U.S.-Russia relations are about whether the world would exist at all, given the number of war arsenals and the trajectory of escalation that the both countries were on the path for the past 3 years. You know, some who in the West argue that, you know, Russia would not dare to go to escalate are pretty much the same people who've been telling their audiences for the 10 years that Putin would do nothing in response to NATO enlargement and would not dare to use force to defend its interests in Georgia and in Ukraine. So I would, you know, be careful thinking that Russia's not going to move there. But a lot of people actually learn from the crisis that there's so much connectivity both to Russia and Eurasia and the U.S. and how these things work. So they really, underappreciated a lot of things that Russia's been doing and the role of Russia in the world. And they're now learning again in a painful way to reassess that role and that relationship with the U.S.
Now, speaking about practical or pragmatic implications of this thaw, one of the things that puzzled me a lot is all this squabble about Ukrainian resources, including the rare earth deal that is now under discussion. And what's notable to me is that the Kremlin is taking a back seat and seeing the West trying to sort of divide whatever is left of Ukraine rather than, trying to get itself into the fray. How do you understand this posture on the part of Russia?
Well, there was an article written by President Putin in 2021 on the historical unity of Russians and Ukrainians, where among his arguments, and if you just forget for a moment about the, Ukrainians and Russians are one people argument, it's the argument is pretty much that normal economic relations with Russia are the only plausible way for Ukraine to function as a normal state. Because in the other states, Ukraine is such a huge country that it cannot live on Western donations. And we know that donations come with certain political price tag and economic price tag. Another option is it really becomes a resource appendage. And it's pretty much given its resources to others. So I think we're seeing somewhat similar to what with this deal. And the third one is you have to normalize economic and trade relations with Russia because no one needs your products in Europe. Look at the reaction of Polish farmers to the European initiative to, help Ukrainian agricultural imports. This is, again, one of the painful realities that if you don't, grapple with timely, you'll just have more problems with it.
So do I understand your answer correctly that Putin is taking a back seat, watching how the West is trying to divide Ukraine among themselves, simply because he knows or he believes that, reality and history will take care of it. And sooner or later, if Ukraine wants to be self-sufficient and sovereign and independent, it will have to come around?
Maybe. But also, I think there is some hidden element here. I think one of the reasons why Ukrainians are not really going forward with this rare earth metals deal with the Americans, my guess only, is that either the British have already have that finger in that pie, or the Ukrainians, acting upon the advice from London to just wait Trump out, and then give the resources and other things to the British or the French or the Europeans.
Now, I also want to ask you about Greenland, because Trump is very open that his national security claims on that land are driven by a desire to counter or augment Russia's dominance, absolute dominance in that region. And it seems that the Kremlin is quite undisturbed by that prospect. In fact, I think it's inviting the White House out and, putting Arctic cooperation as one of the potential boons in mutual diplomacy. Why would Russia be interested in seeing more the U.S. presence in that region?
Well, it depends on what type of U.S. we're talking about, right? If it's, advocates a hostile vision, then, of course, more of U.S. presence just creates another zone of geopolitical rivalry with the United States. If it's the United States that is seeing Russia as a natural kind of partner in the further kind of multipolar world, then perhaps there is some pragmatic element here, because the Arctic is huge, and obviously Russia, it does have a fleet of icebreakers, but it also demands a lot of technology that the United States can provide. So there's a lot of potential for the peaceful discovery of the Arctic together. And perhaps it would make things easier in the Arctic Council if the U.S. kind of political weight is bigger. But then, even if none of that materializes, I think there are some low-hanging fruits for Putin to pick from Trump's squabbles with his allies.
Well, a part of me thinks that the Trump administration may actually benefit from this idea of defending your national security interests by incorporating another country's territory, you know, if it becomes a little bit more widespread, then perhaps it would also help the Trump administration to realize its aspirations. Do you think that may have any implications for the solution of the Ukrainian crisis, that the Americans may actually have an inherent interest in recognizing Russia's territorial, new territorial gains, because it would also make it somewhat easier for the United States to increase its sphere of influence?
I think it will, and it already has. I don't think they will go as far as to legally recognize it as part of the Russian territory. I think they de facto have already recognized it, and, you know, Witkoff in some of his interviews mentioned, you know, that prospect. I don't think they will recognize it legally, because I think there is this kind of widespread consensus, including among some of the members of the Trump administration, the territories were not, you know, incorporated peacefully, so it will be too much for the U.S. But their own potential or possible incorporation of Greenland, I think they will try to make the case of how to incorporate territory through legalistic means, and will, you know, create entire campaign of how to do it peacefully.
Now, Maxim, we are approaching the end of our program, but I do want to ask one more question. You wrote recently that there is one other potential motivation for the two leaders to work together, and that would be the defense of Christian communities in the Middle East. Now, why would Trump or Putin be interested in something like that? Because it's not pragmatic, it's hard to achieve. And yet, do you think there's something
in there? I think 30-plus years of U.S.-Russia relations has been a constant quest for a solid footing in the relations and you know, on what grounds the two countries can work together. You know, disarmament and non-proliferation was a thing of late 1980s, 1990s. You know, in the 2000s, Putin thought it was counterterrorism and, you know, fighting international terrorism. Then, you know, under Medvedev, they thought it was technological innovation that was crushed against the Arab Spring. You know, then Putin thought it would be, you know, fighting against ISIS. None of that worked. But all of these elements, you know, they throughout this time, for this kind of 30-something years, the Christian community in the Middle East have been one of the most persecuted and disprivileged. And look at the terrible shape that they're in. Given the trends within the administration and what, you know, J.D. Vance was talking about, the National Catholic Breakfast and the number of evangelicals, and how these people do not shy away from taking a solid stance on defending, you know, Judeo-Christian values or the conservative values, and how this is a big thing for the Russian domestic politics and history and identity, even though, you know, a lot of people claim, you know, the Muslims and Hindu and Jewish and non-believers, it's still Christianity is 70-plus percent of the Russian population. It's an important political and cultural and identity issue. I think there is a lot of potential there, because, again, and I'm speaking perhaps as a Christian, not as an analyst here, one day God will ask you, what did you do with that chance, whether you exploited it or you did not. And I think there is a moment now where there is a grave problem, and there is genuine interest in Washington and Moscow to pursue that. And maybe, you know, Orthodox evangelicals and Catholics can come together in defense of brothers and sisters of
now,
Christ.
Now, very quickly, since you mentioned your position not as an analyst but as a Christian, do you think there is a potential of the two leaders cooperating on that issue, not as presidents but as human beings or as Christians, because they both of them claim to be Christians?
I do think so. Or at least maybe I hope so. But I think it's morally right and politically advantageous to do it.
Oh, that seems to be a good combination for the day. Thank you very much for being with us. And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.